Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
In the time it takes to finish this introduction, the global population will have swelled by about 150 people. By this time tomorrow, there will be an estimated 228,000 more people on the planet than there are right now. In a week, an additional 1.5 million of us. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Many people fear the Earth can't take it. Even now, environments are being degraded, water sources are drying up, and people are embroiled in conflict over food, land, and energy. The solution, some believe, is slowing and ultimately reversing human population growth so that we bring new lives into a world that, at the very least, has the physical capacity to sustain them. So where is the need greatest and what can be done? Robert Walker is president of the Population Institute and author of its new report, Demographic Vulnerability, Where Population Growth Poses the Greatest Challenges. You can read it online at populationinstitute.org. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be on your program. I've heard many great things about it.
Oh, that's nice to know. The populations of more than 50 countries are currently growing at rates that would double their numbers within 35 years if nothing changes. It doesn't take a lot of growth per year to get to that doubling.
It does not. If a population grows at 2% a year, it will double with every 35 years.
Hmm. In the developed world, birth rates have fallen pretty rapidly over the past century. What are the reasons for that?
Well, first of all, there's the greater availability of contraception. Modern contraceptives have been slow to arrive in many of the developing countries, but as they arrive, many women who want to space or prevent a pregnancy obviously take advantage of modern contraception, and as a result, birth rates are falling.
Do population control efforts have to rely on education and choice, or is that the way they work best? Do you ever see a justification for laws like China's one-child policy in particular circumstances?
Coercion in any form is a violation of human rights. And I think the good news is that we can achieve very substantial reductions in fertility by simply making more contraception available, but also addressing the cultural and informational barriers that prevent women from being able to use contraception. So, for example, in many developing countries today, one of the primary barriers is child marriage. In some countries, girls are married off at the age of 9 or 10, and they begin having children at the age of 12 or 13. And that's a major contributor in many countries today to high fertility.
Is there evidence that these women would prevent pregnancies, or at least some pregnancies, if they had the ability to do so?
Sure. There are estimated right now by the United Nations 225 million women in the developing world who want to avoid a pregnancy, but who are not using a modern method of contraception.
Is it fair to leave all this on the plates of women? I mean, do education efforts need to involve men as well?
Absolutely. In fact, probably one of the greatest barriers to women exercising their reproductive choice, giving them the power to decide how many children they're going to have and when, the biggest barrier in many countries today is male opposition. And that's particularly true in the countries that are growing the most rapidly. And that's particularly true also in areas where child marriage is very prevalent. And in order to change those cultural practices, it's not enough to talk to women. We have to talk to the men.
What would it cost to provide what you call modern methods of contraception to the estimated 225 million women in the developing world who would like to use this stuff but don't have access to it?
The United Nations estimates that to, first of all, serve the 225 million women in terms of their contraceptive needs, but also to improve contraceptive access to other women in the developing world, and that's also an important part of this, would cost only about $5 billion a year. And by any measure in terms of global standards, that's pretty much small change.
What would the net savings be in terms of births or, you know, pregnancies not conceived in a course of any given year?
Well, the impact is really very enormous. I mean, what we see whenever contraceptions are made available is we see a very significant reduction in fertility, but a lot of it depends also upon addressing these other cultural barriers that we talked about, child marriage in particular.
Your report focuses on 20 demographically vulnerable countries with high birth rates. What's remarkable is that a place like Niger has a growth rate currently of less than 4% a year, could triple the population by mid-century if things continue unabated, and is pretty clearly not in a position to sustain more mouths to feed, more people to employ.
Niger is really sort of the perfect example. In the last 10 years, we've seen three major food crises in Niger, primarily driven by drought and climate change. And as a result, Niger has become increasingly dependent over time on emergency food assistance from the World Food Program. But as you indicate, its population is projected, and that's assuming that fertility rates continue to decline. Its population is projected to grow from 18.2 million today to 68 million or even higher, according to the UN estimate. The latest UN estimate indicates that its population will likely grow to 72 million by 2050.
In a place like Sudan, where the average woman gives birth to 7 children over the course of her life, what is the likelihood that all those children will survive to adulthood? And does that play into the high birth rates?
Well, certainly, you know, if we look back half a century ago, we saw in many of these countries very, very high levels of child mortality. In fact, that's one of the reasons why birth rates have been high in these countries and have been high for very, very long, is because of the very high child mortality rates. But child mortality rates in developing countries have gone down fairly substantially in the last half century. So today, if in a country like Sudan, where a woman might have on average 6 or 7 children, where previously she may have lost 2 or 3 or even 4 children to childhood disease or malnutrition, now generally we're going to see six out of those 7 children will live to maturity, if not more.
Is there evidence that there will be a decline in birth rates simply because of those declining mortality rates? That, you know, as people realize that, you know, a generation or two has passed and children have survived, smaller families make more sense?
Well, what we've seen is a rather dramatic decline in child mortality. But what we have not seen is a comparable decline in fertility or birth rates. And that really is the driving force behind all the population growth in developing countries. That is that while we have far, far fewer people dying, we still have a lot of people being born.
There is a clear link between countries with gender inequality and countries with high birth rates. You mentioned the practice of child marriage, which, you know, the child is usually the woman, the female in the marriage. Can you talk about the other factors that cause high birth rates in places where women don't have equal rights?
Well, other factors include religious prohibition. Another major factor in many countries is misunderstanding about modern methods of contraception. There are parts of East Africa, for example, where many women believe that use of condoms, is the way that you get or acquire AIDS. And that's simply not true, of course. In other countries, it's very, very common for women to believe that use of the pill or a long or short-acting injectable designed to prevent pregnancy for a period of time will actually permanently make them sterile. So there's a lot of misconception, in addition to the male opposition and the religious prohibition, that really prevents women from being able to space or limit their pregnancies.
Is there any reason to worry, Bob, that if women are encouraged to have a smaller number of children in places where there is distinct gender inequality, that sex-based infanticide will be practiced at greater rates?
Well, we have seen that in some parts of the world. Certainly, we've seen that in China, where coercion takes place with the one-child policy, and it certainly is a problem in many parts of India. And I think we have to be very, very sensitive to that. And I think the way we address that is by programs that really talk about the empowerment and education of girls, because there's no reason why there should be a preference for males. That's a cultural factor. In reality, if girls and women receive the same opportunity as boys and men, they can make an equal contribution to society and to the welfare of their families. So I think the best way to address this issue of male preference is really to do an educational job, and particularly an educational job in making sure that girls receive the education, same education as boys.
What kind of cultural education works? If you were to come in from the United States and you had a plan for one of the countries, the 20 particularly vulnerable countries that you're worried about, how would you approach that?
Well, our affiliate, the Population Media Center, I think does perhaps one of the best jobs. They use what I call entertainment media. It's really serial dramas, radio serial dramas, or actually soap operas. We call them soap operas for social change because when you take a look at what drives changes in, for example, desired family size or use of contraception or attitudes towards women or attitudes towards the education of girls, those are hardcore social norms. And we know that people's social norms, their behaviors, are largely shaped by role models. And what radio serial dramas can do is provide positive role models for girls, for women, and for men that help to change the social norms about the role of girls and the role of women in society.
And as I understand it, these do not feel like after-school specials. They're every bit as juicy and funny as soap operas tend to be. They're full of, you know, sex and intrigue and scandal. However, underlying the stories are some examples of realities with regard to population growth.
The soap operas produced by the Population Media Center are just like every other soap opera. You have good characters and bad characters.
Evil twins.
And you have transitional characters who are sort of torn between the good influences and the bad influences. The difference is in the soap operas that we produce is that the characters identify really with those transitional characters. They, for example, when we did our first soap opera in Ethiopia, which reached 40 million people, we received over 25,000 letters. Which is quite a significant feat in Ethiopia. And what people were doing is they were responding to the needs of the transitional character. They were identifying with these people and the choices that they had to make. And what they did was they were saying, you know, you've got to make the right decisions. Well, the programs helped to tell them about the consequences of making bad decisions and the good things that happen when you make good decisions.
Developed countries are worried about rapidly aging populations, while those with high fertility rates are worried about what's called, or should be worried about what's called, a youth bulge. Can you talk about what's problematic about having an outsized percentage of young people in any given country?
Well, part of the problem with many of the instability afflicting countries in the Middle East and in other parts of the world with so-called trouble spots is that there are a disproportionately large number of young people, and it varies in terms of definition, but generally the definition is between the ages of 15 and 30. And when you have large numbers of young people and not the jobs to employ them, it is a recipe for social unrest. And we see in virtually all of the developing countries today, that are particularly those that are featured in our report, a very, very high number of young people and a very high level of unemployment amongst those young people.
Because the structures haven't grown up with the population growing at smaller rates. Suddenly there's a youth bulge in the same way that there was a baby boom in this country.
Yeah, and what's happening in many developing countries is arable land, farmland, is now very short. And so when a family has six or seven children and they don't have enough land to divide it up amongst their children, many of those children will leave to try and find employment in the urban centers. And that's where the social unrest really begins to become a major factor, is when you have large number of young people going into major metropolitan areas with no real prospects of a job. That's a recipe for social unrest.
Robert Walker is my guest. He's president of the Population Institute and author of the new report, Demographic Vulnerability, Where Population Growth Poses the Greatest Challenges. Join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or message me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Population Institute President Robert Walker, author of a new report that you can read online called Demographic Vulnerability, Where Population Growth Poses the Greatest Challenges. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You mentioned when we were talking, Bob, about the youth bulge, this move of younger people into urban areas. This also puts many of the world's poorest people at greater risk for hunger, right? Because people aren't simply growing their own food. They have to see what food is going to cost in cities.
That's right, Chris. We're really seeing a changing face of hunger in the world. It used to be when, 25, 30 years ago, when we talked about a food crisis, generally what we meant by that was a famine, for example, in East Africa or in India or some other part of the world that was causing localized suffering. But we've had in the last 5 years two food crises contributed really by high food prices. And what's happened is as the price of basic food staples for rice, for flour, and for other basic food commodities, when those prices double as they have in the last two world food crises, the price of the food budget for a person living on $1 or $2 a day also doubles. And what that means for many people living in urban environments where they have to pay cash for their food is that they go hungry or they cut back on their meals. And so the greater concern is, as we see in sub-Saharan Africa and many parts of South Asia, the growing urbanization of the world's poor is we have to keep an eye not just on local famines, but also on what world food prices are doing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Anna in Denton. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much for having me.
Sure.
I had a question, but now it shifted more toward a comment back to Robert's statement about having limiting policies such the one child in China and violation of individual human rights. In addition to that, it also creates a layer of population of children that are not accounted by the government. I'm talking specifically in China, because parents don't necessarily always follow the policy, and these people fall out of the system. And then you have a whole level of population that is not accounted for, that cannot get legal jobs, that cannot function within the society within the legal framework, and that will also contribute to the increase of violence and crime.
Thanks for your call. Is there anything you want to respond to there, Bob?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, coercion is wrong and entirely unnecessary if the goal is to reduce fertility rates. When you look at China versus its neighbors, the interesting thing is that when you look at fertility rates in Japan and Korea, and Taiwan and Thailand, their fertility rates fell fast or is even faster than China's, and they did so without coercion. So the crucial message here is that if you give women the power, not just access to contraception, but you give women the education that they need, they're generally going to elect to have smaller families. And that's been true all around the world. So coercion is a totally unnecessary an unnecessary approach in addition to being a violation of human rights.
You write that places like the U.S. and Canada and a number of countries in Western Europe have already claimed what's called the demographic dividend by lowering fertility rates. What kinds of advancements in overall well-being can be directly traced to the fact that families are having fewer children?
Well, we had a demographic revolution in many parts of the world over the last half century, particularly, for example, in East Asia, where we saw fertility rates drop very, very dramatically. And what happens when those fertility rates fall, which means that women or couples are having smaller families, is that in very poor countries, they now have more resources to devote to the education of the children that they do have, so educational attainment levels increase. But also, poor families now have more resources to devote to their own economic productivity, and particularly in rural areas where families now can afford more money for seed or more money for fertilizer or more money for irrigation. And what we've seen in country after country where fertility rates have fallen is that there is an economic benefit that ensues. And demographers and economists now call that the demographic dividend. And we've seen it not just in East Asia. We've seen it in many parts of Latin America. It accounts for some of the economic miracle that we've seen in Mexico and Brazil and Chile and Argentina. And we've seen it in many parts of the world. But there are still many developing countries that have yet to make their demographic transition and, as a result, have yet to cash in on their demographic dividend.
I don't recall seeing this in the report, but I wonder if you know if there's evidence that countries that have laws requiring men to pay child support, whether they are married or not, influence them to be more engaged in preventing unwanted pregnancies.
Well, there really are. I'm not familiar with any such law in the developing countries that we looked at in our study. I suspect that even if there are laws, in many cases, the laws are not enforced.
Yeah.
For example, in many countries today, there are laws against child marriage, but the practice of child marriage continues. And for example, in Ethiopia, there are laws against what's called marriage by abduction, where older men who are perhaps in their 20s, 30s, will actually abduct and rape a young girl on their way to school. That's prohibited by law, but it's a cultural practice in many areas that prevails. And so even if there were laws in many of these developing countries requiring child support, which would be certainly a good idea, it's not certain that the law would be enforced.
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who writes, granted, focus should mainly be on the developing world, but how much should we in this country be worried about the rolling back of contraception programs, such as in Colorado or Texas, reverting to promoting abstinence only in schools?
Excellent question, Chris. Our organization, the Population Institute, was created in 1969 by a Methodist minister who had played really a pivotal role in the passage of Title X, the federal program that provides family planning assistance to clinics operating in low-income communities. And now there are attacks in Congress on Title X and some real danger. In fact, the House recently voted to eliminate Title X. But in addition to that, on the state level, we've seen many dramatic cutbacks in family planning in New Jersey, but of course also in Texas, where we saw a few years ago a cutback of essentially two-thirds in the state's support for family planning clinics. And when family planning clinics close, particularly in rural areas, what we find is a lot of women really don't have effective access to family planning services and information. And as a result, what we see is a significant increase in, first of all, the number of unplanned pregnancies that occur. And after that, we also see a significant increase in the number of abortions that are demanded. So the question about access to contraception is one that is global and certainly applies here in the United States as well as to the developing world.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. George is on the line in Plano. Hello, George.
Oh, yes, hi. Yes, sir, I just wanted to kind of add, I was curious as to why we and the Europeans, those of us who are, the most highly developed people in the world, why we are not able to have greater success in using our own pasts over the past 300 years of trying real hard to use our experiences as patterns and demonstrations to be able then to show the poor countries of today how to handle these kinds of problems that you're describing.
Well, the demographic challenges facing some of these developing countries, such as South Sudan and Somalia, many of these countries are countries that today are involved in significant conflict. And I think you have to have a lot of respect for the difficulties that these governments are incurring in trying to take care of the needs of a rapidly rising population, while also dealing with conflict and hunger and water scarcity and other challenges. The United States has a very active program of support on family planning and generally overall in economic assistance. But the needs out there are very, very large indeed, particularly in the countries that we looked at in our report. These countries face very, very significant challenges. And yes, we can offer them our help and our advice, and we should, but we really need to step up the level of aid that we have because these countries face very, very significant obstacles, and we need to help them overcome them.
It might seem to people that this is a severe problem in certain parts of the developing world, but that we can sort of relax in the developed West, in the economically prosperous West. What sort of global impact will there be if population levels continue to rise?
Well, you know, population growth continues to be, for example, a fairly significant driver of the projected increase in carbon emissions going out as it relates to climate change. And certainly that's not an argument for making family planning services available, or at least an argument to, I should say, an argument to women in the developing world that they should use contraception. I think that's not an appropriate argument. But to the extent that we do make family planning services more widely available in the developing world, it will have global impacts. It'll have global impacts in terms of lowering future carbon emissions. It'll have global impacts in terms of the demand for water resources in the world. And it will even have impacts on food prices in the world. So this is truly a global problem of global dimensions. But I want to stress that in our report, I think when we talk about world population, that in addition to all the environmental consequences, which we ought to be concerned about, and those are global in extent, that we cannot lose sight of the fact that population growth is a challenge multiplier for these developing countries, and it presents very, very significant challenges. And we as human fellow human beings, I think, have an obligation to help these countries address those challenges.
800-933-5372 is our number. Steve is on the line now in Carrollton. Hey, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I've got a question as it relates to a population growth in developed countries. It seems to me the common thread is industrialization. Countries that have developed industrial economies have lower birth rates. And it seems also that the obstacle to industrialization and development is corruption. So why aren't we drawing a line between corruption and birth rate?
Well, I don't think there's a direct line between corruption and birth rates, but there's no question that in many of the developing countries where birth rates are high, there is a high level of corruption in the government, and that is a significant problem. And there's been a lot of attempts upon the U.S. and other donor countries to address those corruption problems because they are an inhibitor to economic growth and development. And I don't want to dismiss the importance of addressing those challenges. But again, I think we have to recognize that these countries are in very, very difficult circumstances. When you have a country, as we talked about earlier, about Niger, a country that is undergoing severe food shortages, and it has a population growth that's going to grow triple in the next 35 years, we need to do more about corruption in Niger, but we also need to address the other problems there, the hunger, the poverty, and we need to address the fertility.
We've spoken briefly about the link between girls being educated, young women being educated, and the delaying of first pregnancy, which could potentially forestall future pregnancies. What plays into that correlation? Is it simply that young women are busy doing other things and they don't have children, or that they suddenly are empowered to understand the possibilities for preventing pregnancy that they're not ready for?
Well, it really works both ways. There actually are a number of people who say, well, the solution to population is simply education, meaning that if you educate girls and you empower women, they will elect on their own to have smaller families. And there's certainly a lot to that. But at the same time, when you look on the ground and you look at these developing countries, you look at the circumstances in which these families are struggling, what you find is that unless contraception is first of all made available so that women have the option of being able to space their pregnancy, or that young women, particularly young women who, you know, married as child brides, have the opportunity to prevent a pregnancy or delay a pregnancy until they've completed their schooling, it's not very realistic to think that we're going to raise or increase the educational attainment levels in those countries unless we also make access to contraception more widely available.
1-800-933-5372, our number. Helly is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Helly. Or Healy.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Okay. The question here is that that someone mentioned about industrialization as sort of solving the problem. But industrialization leads to more urbanization, and more urbanization leads to a loss of habitat for poor humans and animals. It relates to poor humans because they can't afford the houses, they can't afford the food as the price goes up. And so they're left homeless and on the street. The animals, because it encroaches on land that would normally be used for their habitat, for farming, etc., is also reduced.
What do you think about that, Bob?
Well, I think Healy makes a good point in that population growth is not just a matter of concern to we humans. It's also a matter of concern to every other species on the planet. Leading biologists are warning right now that the planet is entering into the sixth mass extinction of plant and animal species as a result of the expanding human presence on the planet. What we're really doing in many parts of the world, we've already done it here in North America, is to lead to the extinction or the dramatic loss in population of many animal species. You know, when before the first English settlers came here, you looked at North America, we had huge populations of bison, the buffalo, and there were many bird populations that effectively have been eliminated since we've arrived here, and our population has quite exploded in the last 300 years in North America. And that impact is being felt around the world. I think it's really sad to think that, you know, in my lifetime, if not my lifetime, the lifetime of certainly children and grandchildren listening to hear that generation, we're going to see the virtual extinction of lions, of tigers, of elephants, of rhinoceros, and other large mammals. And that's an enormous human tragedy. And a lot of that's being driven by loss of habitat as a result of human numbers.
Robert Walker is my guest. He's president of the Population Institute and author of the new report, Demographic Vulnerability, Where Population Growth Poses the Greatest Challenges. You can find the whole thing online at populationinstitute.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Robert Walker. He's president of the Population Institute, which has just published a report called Demographic Vulnerability, Where Population Growth Poses the Greatest Challenges. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Jonah in Austin. Hey, Jonah.
Hi. I am calling because I wanted to ask comment on, there's a sort of a paternal tone that I hear when it comes to population as regards different countries on the African continent or in, quote, developing countries. And I know because I have relatives who are from different African countries that and we talked about this issue of population when people from maybe the European countries or even from the United States address population in regards to those countries, it's kind of paternalistic because in those particular countries and in those cultures, in their particular groups, having children, there's a joy. And to say that coercion, that these organizations such as yours is against direct coercion, because in a roundabout way there's indirect coercion through the different programs, i.e. the girls programs, I should say, as you call it. There's a cultural clash. Is that to be ignored? That what if they don't want to, quote, reduce their populations? And I think it seems like that there's really, I guess, and I guess you addressed the issue because of concerns over environmental issues, which was a concern in the 70s. There was this big push to reduce population, as if the world was going to implode, when we know that that didn't happen. And it seems like that it's rearing its head again as the African countries seem to be going toward that, you know, more than, I guess, 1 billion mark.
Well, Janet, you raised some really interesting points there, and I want to make sure that Robert has time to address them. So thank you so much for your call. And let's talk about this. Bob, is it reasonable to say that this is somewhat paternalistic for the developed world to point to the developing world and say this is what you really ought to do?
Well, two things. First of all, if you talk to leaders in the developing world, they recognize that this is a very significant challenge, and they welcome assistance from the United States and other donor countries. But it's really not paternalistic when you think about it in terms of what we're saying is that every woman, and we're talking about developing countries, every girl should be able to space or prevent a pregnancy, that she should be able to determine how many children she will have and when, and that she should make that decision free from male opposition and free from religious prohibition, and she should make it as a fully informed decision. I don't think that's paternalistic. I think that's highly pro-women, and I think when we talk about this problem, we have to recognize that a lot of it, again, as I've talked about earlier, is about the education of girls. That's not paternalistic. I think this is really very much a question of empowering girls and women. That's the key here, and I think that's something that increasingly leaders in the developing world recognize as important and welcome assistance from the United States and other donor countries.
In parts of the world where young women and girls, teenage girls, are married off early, sometimes that's because their families can no longer afford to keep them, to feed them. Are there ways to work with these families to provide the assistance necessary to keep young women at home longer until they are closer to what would appear to us to be the age of adult consent to marriage?
Yeah. In countries where girls are married at ages, let's say, for example, in many developing countries, at the ages generally around 12 or 13 or 14, there is an economic incentive for marrying off girls, and many programs have been tried to sort of reverse those economic incentives. For example, programs have been done in Ethiopia and Tanzania and other countries where in exchange for keeping girls in school, families may receive a goat or a couple of chickens, and that is enough of an economic incentive for them to say, oh, well, in that case, I'm going to make sure that my girl continues to receive education and stays in school. So there are certainly those type of economic incentives that can be employed to encourage parents to keep their girls in school. But a lot of this is also really deeply socially, culturally rooted, and I think we have to also address those social norms, and that's why we talked about earlier about the power of entertainment media, of radio serial dramas, to sort of change those social norms, to make it the social norm in those countries for girls to complete their primary and secondary education, to make it possible for young girls who've completed primary and secondary school to go on to college. So I think we need to address it on multiple levels.
We should say that those serial dramas in video form on demand are available in the United States as well.
Yeah, the Population Media Center work for the most part is in developing countries. But a little over 3 years ago, the Population Media Center produced a program called East Los High, which aired on Hulu, which is one of the leading online entertainment centers today, and it was addressing the issue of teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases, and it was addressed primarily to a Latino population, and it was wildly popular on Hulu. It became, in fact, the number one program, Latino program on Hulu, and one of the top five programs on Hulu, and that's because it was a compelling social drama. It talked about the social lives of Latino youth and the questions they have about their sexuality and questions about teen pregnancy. And it was a program produced by Carlos Portugal, one of the top producers, directors in Hollywood, had an all-Latino cast, And it was extremely popular. But at the same time, it had a very serious message behind it, particularly a message talking about the importance of young Latino men taking responsibility for their sexuality and taking responsibility for preventing pregnancies. So we're actually now in the process of doing another soap opera, our second one in the United States. This one will take place in Harlem, in New York. We're doing it in cooperation with the Harlem Children's Zone. And there, you know, our primary emphasis is going to be really in upon the completion of education. That when you look at the challenges facing urban African-American youth, one of the problems, of course, is dropout rates. And the Harlem Children's Zone, which has done really great, outstanding work in helping to keep children in school, expressed interest to us in doing a soap opera to address some of those social and cultural norms that cause young people to drop out of school. So, you know, it's not just overseas. We have problems here in the United States as well. The teen pregnancy rate here in the United States is about the highest in the industrialized world. And teen pregnancy is a problem whether it occurs here in the United States or whether it occurs overseas, because it really robs a young girl, a young woman, from a lot of her potential, particularly if it forces her to drop out of school. So, you know, we're actually contemplating the possibility, the Population Media Center is, at some point working in partners with organizations in Texas and perhaps doing a serial drama in Texas about the challenges facing young people in Texas today. So it's not just a case of looking overseas. Contraception is an important thing. It may be a very small thing, but it's a very important thing to people. And giving people the power to control their own destinies, I think, is a good thing. And that's true whether it's in the United States or overseas.
In this country, are religious beliefs a primary impediment to the use of contraceptives?
No. In the United States, we know that use of contraception is as prevalent amongst Catholics as it is amongst Protestants. There really are no significant religious barriers to the use of contraception. I mean, that's certainly what the surveys suggest, that women of all religious faiths, generally at some point in their life, will use contraception in this country. So, and that, you know, for example, in Latin America, which is predominantly Catholic, and where the church prohibits the use of modern methods of contraception, use of those modern contraceptives is about at the same level as in the United States in many of these countries today. So, but there are parts of the world, for example, in the Philippines and some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, where the teachings of the Catholic Church have been effective in preventing women from using modern methods of contraception, but not here in the United States. I don't think it's much of a significant factor here.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Bruce on the line in Arlington. Hey, Bruce.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to address, I think you stated multiple times, but in terms of education, I think when we look at the education policies in America, the multiple states that have high teen pregnancies, but the teaching of proper scientifically based sexual education is lacking, not just in states, but communities. There's no like national standard of what's appropriate. And I hear a lot about teaching girls, but there should also be teaching, it's a two-part thing where young boys need to be taught about their own sexual anatomy and how to use safe sex. A lot of girls, they might be forced by boys, or not forced, but like, they don't know, both of them don't know the proper education on their own anatomy and good sex education.
Certainly it takes two to make a baby, Bob Walker.
Yeah, it's important for both boys and girls. And what we need are sex education programs that are proven to be effective. And what we've known in states all across the country is that as you increase what we call comprehensive sex education in the schools, which not only encourages abstinence, but at the same time talks about contraception and how to prevent pregnancies, we see as a result lower and lower teenage pregnancy rates in this country. We've actually made a lot of really very significant progress in this country in lowering teenage pregnancy. We're still about the highest amongst the industrialized countries, but we've made a lot of substantial progress. We want to keep that progress, however, continuing. And in order to do that, we need effective sex education programs for both boys and girls.
Many people believe, and there are there is research to back this up, that abstinence-only education doesn't work for as many people as comprehensive sex education. Why does abstinence education fail to prevent unwanted pregnancies?
Well, the fact of the matter is that there are hormonal changes that take place as we go from being a youth to an adolescent, and that's sort of natural. You know, I grew up in a community. I grew up as a Baptist, and virtually all my friends were attending either Baptist or another church and were highly religious and were taught abstinence. But the fact of the matter is, in the town where I grew up, there were a lot of teenage pregnancies, and that occurred despite the teachings of the church. And I think it's important that we do whatever is effective to reduce teenage pregnancy. That's the key question here. What's the most effective means of preventing teenage pregnancy? And that's not to say we shouldn't encourage and preach abstinence, but at the same time, it means we also need to educate young people about contraception and how it works.
Does the Population Institute have a recommended number of children per couple, per adult couple? Is it replacement rate like 2.1 or something?
No, we don't have any. And the reason for that is that, first of all, we believe that coercion is wrong. And I think if you start setting targets or quotas, that sometimes leads to coercion. I think it's far more effective simply to talk about giving every girl and woman in the world the ability to space or prevent a pregnancy. Because we know when that happens, when women are truly free to make a decision, they will have smaller families and their fertility rates will fall down to around the replacement rate or lower. That's true here in the United States, and we're confident it's true virtually in every country in the world.
If we care about this issue from here in the United States, particularly as it affects the developing world, what can we do about it?
Well, a couple things. First of all, you can visit our website, which is www.populationinstitute.org, or our partner, the Population Media Center, which is www.populationmedia.org. But, you know, there are debates right here in this country today at both the federal and state levels about what is the appropriate level of assistance for family planning clinics in this country, and what should be done in terms of making contraception available through insurance to individuals. And I think it's important for people to let their elected representatives know that they regard access to contraception as an important issue, that it's one that means a lot to people at the personal level, and also means a lot at the larger country level as well. So I think people need to think more closely about this issue, about the consequences of failure to support family planning, whether through private contributions or whether through government programs. So I would encourage your audience to give more thought as to not just overseas, but here in the United States as well, as to what we can do to make sure that every woman has access to a contraceptive method that's appropriate for her.
Robert Walker is president of the Population Institute and author of its new report, Demographic Vulnerability. You can read it online at populationinstitute.org. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening to Think. Have a great day.